Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Midnight Mass Podcast. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and I'm here with my fantastic co-host, the one, the only, it's Michael Verratti.
Well, hello, hello, Peaches. And you know, if there's one thing we're certain of here at the Midnight Mass Podcast, it's that faith sometimes can be a circus.
Well, and I mean, look at me. I'm a clown. I love a circus. In fact, who doesn't love a circus? I suppose there are people who don't like clowns. That we know for sure. But circuses, for any of us weirdos, for any of us outsiders, I think fantasy of running away to join a circus is part of our DNA. Michael, why are we talking about circuses so much?
Well, we're talking about circuses because they play an integral part in this week's movie, which, of course, is 1989's Santa Sangre, directed by the legendary Alejandro Jodorowsky, written by Alejandro Jodorowsky, Roberto Leone, and Claudio Argento, and starring Axel Jodorowsky, Blanca Guerra, Aidan Jodorowsky, Guy Stockwell, and a whole city full of unusual people and things.
It's one of these films that is so unique and so special and so lovely that it's almost hard to even describe. And it's something that needs to be experienced. And I know that we get into our entrance into the world of Santa Sangre with our conversations with our special guests. But I did want to say, and I know I say it later as well, I'm really grateful to Squeaky Blonde for sharing this with me because this was her favorite movie. And you gotta understand, Squeaky Blonde, drag sister of mine, for those of you that are on the Patreon, you may have seen her as the star of A Nightmare on Castro Street, which is up over on our Patreon page, a short film I made way back when. It really highlights Squeaky and I's friendship in many ways. But Squeaky and I bonded over our shared love of music and movies, specifically weird movies and weird music. And Squeaky said, you gotta see my favorite movie of all time. There was no turning back. I'd seen El Topo. I had not seen this. And it's blown my mind. And rewatching it for this podcast has been such a lovely reminder of like how special this film is and how brilliant and beautiful it is. What was your first experience with it?
This movie was one of those that I did come to a little later when I was exploring the work of this filmmaker. I had first become aware of Jodorowsky because of El Topo. El Topo is one of those tentpole movies that's often talked about as being crucial to the midnight movie movement. And it is synonymous with him and the midnight movie experience, much like Night of the Living Dead is to Romero or Pink Flamingos is to John Waters. And when the midnight movie circuit was rolling out, it was one of those like five movies that played quite frequently. And I'd heard about it and been recommended it so much that I bought a DVD box set of his films, Sight Unseen, and watched El Topo first because I just felt like I needed to. And I fell in love with it. And then Holy Mountain was in that box set, which became my favorite of his works at the time, as well as Fondo Elis. But that box did not contain Santa Sangre. And for a while, Santa Sangre, at least to my memory, was a little bit harder to come by despite being one of his most lauded films. And because it wasn't included in the box set that I had, I just kind of kept neglecting seeing it. So then fast forward many years later, a copy came my way. I was delighted to discover that Dario Argento's brother had a hand in the making of this film because it was just sort of like a cross-section of a lot of international filmmakers that I liked. And then I watched it and I couldn't believe that it had taken me so long because it is an exquisite movie. It's beautiful. It's grotesque. It's all of the things that you see in his work, but also in a very different way. And I was really captivated. It's a truly, truly special film.
Yeah, unlike El Topo, which is essentially a Western, which I like. I like El Topo. Don't get me wrong. It is a great movie. But it's Santa Sangre that is so queer and so drag. The religious stuff. I mean, this is, of course, you know, I was going to freak out when I saw this film. And for those of you who are listening to the podcast and haven't seen it, obviously, we are hoping that you will go out and discover this film. One of the reasons we wanted to cover this film specifically is that Michael and I love it so much, but also the guests we have on love it. But we also knew it was one of those movies, unlike The Craft, where we kind of hope in our little way that maybe we're introducing this film to some virgins because, oh my God, it deserves to be enjoyed by everyone that listens to the podcast. Now, you brought up Dario Argento's brother, Claudio, had a hand in this film. We know he was the co-writer of the film. He's also the producer of the movie. So another theme that we seem to be leaning into totally coincidentally are films produced by the Argentos, because of course we just covered Bava's Demons. And that actually is kind of a coincidence. But I will say this, what it has brought up to me, because I kind of don't think about things like Demons and Santa Sangre in the same universe.
Sure.
Is that the Argentos are so much more than just the giallo films that they are famous for. This is another example of an Argento-produced film that gives way to unapologetic and audacious creative freedom. And, you know, the kind of movie that you can just tell this is a singular artist's vision. And Jodorowsky was clearly supported by Claudio Argento in the making of this movie. And that sort of collaborative spirit is so cool. It's so cool to see that international, oh, you're an auteur? Well, I'm the brother of an auteur. Let me help you make your movie. It's so great.
Yeah, and it was such a collaboration that the film is a joint production between the nations of Mexico and Italy. And I think that even though this is a very much rooted in the landscape and folklore of Mexico story, there are elements of this movie where you can see little hints of that Argento-ness creep in, if that makes sense.
Well, let's face it, a big running theme of this film is religion, spirituality, Catholicism. And if any two countries, I mean, they have their own version of it. But, you know, if I were to choose the two countries that maybe have the most intensity around their Catholicism, I guess you could say maybe Ireland. But I would say Italy and Mexico, in my experience, you know, as far as like, woohoo, this is some crazy shit.
Yeah. So one of the things that...
Sorry if that was offensive to all you hardcore Catholics out there, but...
Because they're listening to our show so frequently.
It's crazy shit.
One of the things I love about all of his films, but especially Santa Sangre, is it's so strikingly visual. And there are so many sequences in this that feel like you're looking at a painting or like a living mural in a way. And I wonder, Peaches, for you, are there any outstanding images that you really, really love in this movie?
Well, we talk about the elephant sequence with one of our guests a little bit later, but I found that whole section to be shocking and beautiful and striking. That is very memorable. But I guess it's, how would you describe it? The puppeteering, the use of hands, giving the gift of their hands to someone who no longer has them.
Yes.
And maybe because of what I'm dealing with my dear friend Pippi. And for those of you who don't know, dear friend of mine recently became a quadruple amputee. And so watching this film post that happening kind of maybe had a different layer of intensity for me, because I was with my friend when she found out that she was going to lose all her limbs and been going through that with her. You know, this movie is one of those movies, as cheesy and cliched and tongue in cheek as it is, it sounds like a John Waters, you know, line, but this is hardcore art. You know what I mean? Like, there are those movies where you're like, holy shit, this is hardcore art. So I don't know. The whole movie is memorable. The streetwalker sequence with the sex workers in the streets of Mexico City. Anyway, I could go on and on. Sorry, Michael, what about the demolishing of the church at the beginning? Like, it is crazy.
I mean, the demolishing of the church would be one of my picks, because it's one of the images that just is so indelible in my brain, because it communicates in many ways what this movie is. It's this space between the garish and the fanatical, the devoted and the demented, you know, this idea that there's a thin line for all of these things. And I love that you used the phrase hardcore art, because this movie is hardcore art. It explores these themes in a none too subtle way, in the best of ways. You know, I think the thing is, there is extraness, to borrow a phrase from the kids, to how the film frames all of the elements that you can't help but just submit to what you're looking at. It's sort of a battery of the senses. And that is what sells the movie. It's like, life is hard. Life is an onslaught of so much. It's not going to be subtle. It's going to be bright. It's going to be colorful. It's going to be everything, everywhere, all at once, you know? And I think that that's what really makes this movie special. And the fact that we start with the church, really, and how over the top that image is, in a way, you as audience member who are maybe seeing this movie for the first time think, well, there's nowhere we can go from here. But oh, no, no. We're going everywhere from here.
We're going from one circus to another.
Exactly.
Well, I have to say, Michael was able to book our first guest. And oh my God, if I wasn't a fan before, I'm a fan now. She is wonderful. And the perspective she offers about the film is so personal and so special that I'm just so thrilled that you were able to bring her on the show, Michael.
Well, not only was I able to bring her on the show, in fairness, she is the person who brought this movie to us.
Right. Yes.
I had attended a premiere screening of the movie Malum here in Los Angeles a number of months back, and we happened to be seated next to each other, and we were talking, and Midnight Mass came up, and she said, well, have you done Santa Sangre yet? And I was like, no, but then I ran home and called Peaches and was like, look, we got to do Santa Sangre. And because she motivated that discussion, I said, well, if anybody is going to talk about it, it's got to be her. And let's face it, this person is an icon of contemporary horror. She is the filmmaker behind such movies as Bingo Hell, Culture Shock. She's worked on the Purge series. She just contributed segments to VHS 85 and Satanic Hispanics. She's a director, a writer, a producer. She's so much, and we adore her. It's Gigi Sal Guerrero here to talk to us about Santa Sangre right now. Welcome back, listeners. Our next guest's resume is so insanely impressive, in some ways, I don't even know where to begin. I first became aware of this remarkable individual at a film festival where I saw her acclaimed short film, El Gigante, about a cannibalistic luchador, and immediately knew I needed to seek out more. The co-founder of the sensational Luchagore Productions, this multifaceted artist has been behind such celebrated short films as Dead Crossing, Dia de los Muertos, Slam, Testament, and Madre de Dios, to name a few. She's the filmmaker of such features as Culture Shock from Blumhouse's Into the Dark series, Amazon's Bingo Hell, and served as the director for an episode of the Purge television series. Recently, she has contributed segments to VHS 85, as well as the groundbreaking Satanic Hispanics anthology films. And, also a prolific actor and performer, she's appeared in such film and TV as Trap House, The Puppet Killer, Angry Birds, Summer Madness, Super Monsters, and yes, she even provided the voice of Spider-Girl in several episodes of Marvel Superhero Adventures. You've probably even seen her in commercials being the spokesperson for products as far-ranging as toothpaste and chips. She's a writer, director, producer, actor, and so much more. It's Gigi Sal Guerrero. Gigi, welcome to the show.
Woohoo! Thank you. You can call me Dr. Garcia from now on. What a nice intro. I need you like a Polly Pocket just like next to me whenever. Yes. I need an introduction. I'm just going to bring you out of my pocket, be like, here, listen to her.
Well, I know that you travel so often that if I were to travel with you to do intros, I'd get to go a lot of places. You know, during the time we were coordinating this interview, you were all over the place.
I was. So it's nice to travel, you know, even after how crazy our world has been for the past 4 years. It's like, it's nice that you get to pretend to be busy, you know, get to travel and just pretend to be busy as much as you can.
And not take it for granted, right? Like after the experience of being told, not only are you not traveling, you're not leaving your house.
Totally.
It's sort of like, oh, wow, I get to go and see the world. You know, you can't take that for granted. It's so amazing. Well, Dr. Garcia, we are here today to discuss a film that we all love. And so what is your first memory of seeing Santa Sangre? And did you love it right away? How did you receive it when you first saw it?
I love this question. It's so unexpected how I came about to watching this film. Well, for most people that know me, I come from a very Catholic, very strict, old school Mexican household. So for my family, especially my mom and my abuela, may she rest in peace, everything is a devil. Okay. Like you put your purse on the ground and immediately, oh my God, the devil's going to take your money. Like everything is like the devil is here. Don't do anything. Don't have sex. It's all that stuff, right? Like that's where I come from.
Right.
So I honestly, growing up, I didn't get to see much. It was always like a rebellious thing to watch a horror movie. So for me as a kid, it was always watching American movies like Chucky and Freddy Krueger and all those films. Like that was for me in Mexico what was super cool. And it wasn't until we moved to Canada and I discovered all the love for film. On my first year of film school, one of my teachers, he was a cinematography teacher. Very white man, old classic white man, very, very nice guy. And he was like, you know, I've seen this movie. I don't even know if it's Mexican, but you kind of remind me of it because you like all this weird culty stuff. And I was like, oh, well, what's it called? He's like, it's from back in my time, Santa Sangre. And I was like, okay, oh, Santa. Oh, you mean Santa Sangre? Okay. Sure, he's like, watch it. I recommend it. It's not a movie I talk much about. And so he's the one that recommended it to me. And I went home. I immediately was like, okay, yeah, let's watch it. I love what, you know, discovering new Mexican films or films that take place in Mexico, anyways. And I remember the next day coming to class and being like, you liked that? I had so much more respect for my teacher that I thought he only liked, you know, very, very specific high class movies. And he was like, yeah, just, you know, I don't tell my wife that kind of stuff. And so that was my first memory, was immediately just being so shocked being recommended a movie like this, which kind of gave me hope that there is hope in the world, that people do recommend that kind of stuff. So definitely on my first year of film school is when I saw it. So it took me a long time.
What I really love about that origin story is you singling out the Catholicism at the heart of this movie, because when you look at El Topo, Holy Mountain, they are sort of removed from that section of the world's religion, kind of
I would agree
religious
with that.
ideology. And it's interesting about Santa Sangre because, and I'm wondering in some ways if it's partially due to the fact that it's an Italian co-production as well. So you've got these two sort of Catholic nations bringing a lot of Catholicism to the table. It sets this film in his filmography apart in some ways. And I saw this later. So I was more used to the metaphysical work that he had done in movies that I had referenced. And I'm wondering, starting with Santa Sangre and then seeing some of his other stuff, how did it compare for you?
That's an awesome question. I couldn't agree more. I related a lot to Santa Sangre because I found that the themes were actually clearer than his other films. Like I can actually point out a good five in this one. Definitely religion, definitely like womanhood, child abuse, even family, almost like family origins. I think there was just so many topics in Santa Sangre that were actually quite clear and linear too. Like the narrative is brutal, sure, but it's actually a very clear story of where things are going. And when I've seen Alejandro's other stuff, I feel a little lost of what's going on. Visually, it's always striking.
Right.
But this is probably his most linear story, in my opinion, anyways, that you know, even for some people who I've talked to, they feel Santa Sangre was trying to say too much. But to me, I'm like, you know, it was just showing the underbelly of Mexico City. It's showing the underbelly of maybe any city, with no filters, no rules, no restrictions, of just showing truly our society of where it could be. And especially the biggest thing that stood out to me in this film is the class system, how divided it really is, especially in South America. And coming from Mexico, I really understand that. It's so divided. You are either very poor, low class, or you're middle class. There's no in between. So you have your life pretty set, pretty okay, no high, no lows, or you're upper class, and there's no middle in between those. So we're so divided in that sense that I quite appreciated. I hadn't seen a movie yet at the age that I saw Santa Sangre that really showed the divide, and the corruption of Mexico, and just bringing the genre into it, I have yet to see somebody do that again in that capacity. So visually striking too. So yeah, I mean, I think Alejandro brought so many themes that it's quite incredible. And I've seen the movie a good 4 or 5 times. And believe it or not, my mom sat through the whole film. She could barely get through When Evil Lurks last week. I uploaded a video on Twitter and she just walked right out. She just walked right out in the goat scene. I really wanted her to see the dog scene, but she couldn't get through it. And when we've seen Santa Sangre together a few years back, my mom actually sat through the whole thing, suffering through it. But she really, really understood all these themes that we're talking about, especially the divide in the class system in Mexico. And hearing my mom, who's super, super religious, she could feel so much of that spirituality in the movie, especially the closeness with the funeral of the elephant, how it brought everybody together. So much of feeling this slave, this bond relationship with the son and the mom, you know, doing all this for her. And even more so, just the commitment of this guy to his mother. Like she really understood that, coming from a pretty harsh background with my grandma and my mom's dad. So it was interesting to see my mom sit through the whole thing and point out the different streets and buildings that she could recognize in the movie. And she knows that those are the places in Mexico that you just don't go to by yourself still today. One fun fact, because I feel like I'm rambling on.
Not at all.
My mom immediately, as soon as the movie started, the first thing you see in that film is that this is Alejandro's film right away, a film by. And my mom's like, wait a second, he taught me theater. I was at his theater class. And
oh,
I was like,
my God.
What? Really? She's like, yes. And then he went off to be a director. And I was like, what? I was like, okay. So this all good. This all meant to be.
That's amazing.
And she sat through it. I think that's why, because she did a theater class with Alejandro.
That is amazing. Wow. I love that experience of you as a horror fan, as a genre fan, getting to share, you know, something like When Evil Lurks with your mom and engage the reaction. But the fact that she sat and watched and enjoyed this movie that is kind of grotesque. It is painful,
it is, yes.
But it's also melodramatic and it's heartfelt. I hadn't thought about the class part of it because it didn't strike me the way it's going to strike someone, obviously, who's Mexican and
yeah,
you know, experiences it in a different way. But now that you point it out, it's something that's there. And for me, I look back on my experience with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a kid who was always obsessed with cult movies. I've built a whole career as a drag persona celebrating cult movies. This podcast is about cult movies. And so in college, when I was doing my deep dive, it was El Topo, El Topo, El Topo. That's the movie of his that you need to see. It's kind of like the Pink Flamingos to John Waters or Eraserhead to David Lynch or whatever. And so it wasn't until later, and I liked El Topo, but I didn't connect with it the same way the straight guys who were doing a lot of drugs and going to see midnight movies connected to it. I wasn't really a big Western person. It was later when my sister Squeaky Blonde, who's a Mexican drag queen that I, you know, grew up with, said, oh, no, you need to see Santa Sangre. And I was probably 22. And we bonded over that movie so much. And part of it was the outsider of it all, the Catholic upbringing, the circus elements, the freaks of it, you know, as outsiders, as drag performers, as colorful, wild queers. There's queer people in this film. There's, you know, this sort of street folks in the city scenes in the circus juxtaposed to sort of church and religion. This was all stuff that I identified with so much. So I like Michael's question because I think for some of us, not to say anything bad about El Topo, amazing 1970 acid Western, brilliant film, but a filmmaker 20 years later to come out with something like Santa Sangre.
Yeah, I love everything you said. It honestly feels timeless. We watch it today and the themes of empathy, the themes of being an outsider, I think that's what makes the movie so powerful. It does not feel aged at all. It's eye-opening. The movie. It's 100% eye-opening. And I think for somebody like my mom, growing up middle class in Mexico City and witnessing a lot of what happens in the streets in Mexico, back in the day, you could not in Mexico be gay. You could not at all be a freak. You can't even be discriminating in any way, especially it's so against our Catholic beliefs. But you go to the underbelly of Mexico City and everything you see in Santa Sangre, when we watch it, we actually feel it's very true. We actually feel, well, yeah, that is exactly how it's always been.
I like what you said about the timelessness of this, because I really am interested in the fact that the movie is presented by and large without judgment, with the exception of judgment of power structures. And when Peaches mentions the kind of queer presentation in the movie, one of the things that I zero in on is the luchador that is presented in first sort of a comical way, but then quite empathetically. And yeah. I really, really appreciate how this movie deals with that character, because other movies of this era would have made a joke. Yeah. And this movie asks you to root for that person and asks you to understand that this person is being put into a terrible circumstance. And I really, really like that character. And I like that moment. And in our intro, I talked about El Gigante. I know that luchador is an allusion to luchadors. So I just wanted to ask you about the luchador of it all in this movie, since you seem to have a connection to the world of lucha.
I love that. Listen, I watch this movie and I always gasp with so much of the imagery. The circus imagery, the Mexico imagery, the freaks imagery, the streets, and especially suddenly out of nowhere, we're in a lucha ring. And I'm always like, man, I love, Alejandro touched on so much of our culture in general. And the luchador scene, badass, that we see a strong, gigante woman, you know, like we see someone huge. And we don't see that ever, honestly. I think maybe this new movie coming out with...
Oh, Love Lies Bleeding.
Yeah.
Which I saw last week.
And
is... I don't want to give anything away, but your connection there is spot on. Oh my God.
I couldn't think about it again.
You just wait. And it is so good.
Exactly.
And you're going to love it.
Oh,
it is so good.
Wait.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I saw the trailer to that film a couple weeks ago. And the first thing I thought of was the luchadora in Santa Sangre. I have yet to see someone with that statue of a body, with that presence of a body, with that just presence in general in film, that's female. I haven't, to be completely honest with you. I have not since Santa Sangre. So yeah, I couldn't help but connect it. I love that you asked this, because it was the first thing that came to my mind. I'm like, hey, it's La Luchadora from Santa Sangre, many years later.
You'll see.
Yeah, perfect.
That movie is so great. It's so inspiring. In a week, I got to see Problemista and I got to see Love Lies Bleeding. And I'm telling the listeners right now, we are off to a good start.
Yes.
These are queer films that are unapologetically what they are, and they are brilliant and beautiful. And especially Love Lies Bleeding. I'd be surprised to find out she wasn't incredibly inspired by Horowski, because the visuals are surreal. And would you just wait? I don't want to go on. I want you to see it kind of the way I did, where I just walked in only having seen the trailer and then, you know, mind blown. So speaking of visuals, I think with this filmmaker in particular and this movie in particular, I think the other thing that is timeless about it is that the technicality of filmmaking that is achieved in this film.
Yes.
You know, I think, and actually there's another filmmaker back in the 60s, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, Russ Meyer presented large shit-kicking sexy women. And it was so ahead of its time that the public could not handle it. It wasn't until the 80s when people go, hey, this movie, we should be looking at this, you know, and then Quentin Tarantino and John Waters lauded it and kind of brought it back out. This film, like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, has a technical achievement that often isn't talked about, because we talk about all the sensational things about the film because it is so sensational. But the way this film is shot, the imagery, the ballet of cinematography with movement and background, folks, as all of us being filmmakers, we know this is not easy, especially to do in big cityscapes, you know. I was just blown away rewatching it for this podcast by the imagery itself. You know, Spain has Almodovar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Italy has Fellini. You know, it's like there are these filmmakers who come along and capture images that are indelible, that are culturally significant. And I don't really have a question as much as like, I just was blown away by how well shot the film is, how beautiful it is. Yeah.
And it takes turns from keeping the shots gritty, raw, actually quite imperfect. They're not perfect for a reason, but then all the intimate scenes, it's not even interior scenes, all the intimate scenes that are just one-on-one of the son with whoever character, usually a woman, there is such a delicate hand to the shots. I don't know where, you know, it starts to be some sort of steady cam when the son and the mother are singing together on the piano, having this strange romance to them. And it's quite frankly beautiful. I don't think at the time we've been able to see shots that smooth that just go fully around a set to music. But like this movie does achieve a lot and convey a lot of language through the camera. To suddenly big, wide, intense shots of the elephant carcass, you know, feeding all these people, and it's handheld and it goes nuts. But then suddenly it slows down again and it becomes intimate. It becomes super close up. And you feel everything in this film. You feel, even going back to the La Luchadora character, I am a huge fan that it took a long time. And it might be just a detail that some of us could point out, but I love that it took a long time to see her face. Mm-hmm. And in Mexican culture, you cannot take off your mask, your luchador mask, not just because you're qualified, but that is so against the lucha religion of everything. Like, you cannot show your face, period. And I love that when we meet her in the shower with him, it's so steamed up and fuzzy and blurry, and it's over the shoulders and you can't see her face at all. You just see this giant silhouette of a woman. And it's not until she dresses up out of the ring, out of her comfort zone, that you see her. And I was like, I bet that was a detail on purpose. It makes me really happy, those subtle choices that are incredible.
When you think about the subtlety of the film and what makes the film work, I think about how when you as a filmmaker, and this is the universal you, one of the things that we are all taught is that film, unlike the stage, is a contained medium. So things have to be smaller. It has to be within a certain space. It has to be within a certain frame. So many filmmakers and artists, when making movies, adjust to that space. Everything gets a little smaller. Everything gets a little more controlled. But here's a movie where almost all of the elements are theatrical.
Yes.
Circus is theatrical. Church is theatrical. Lucha is theatrical. I mean, the idea even that the mimicry with the hands, that's a form of miming, and that's big. And I'm wondering if what makes this work so much is he understands that film is a contained space and sort of says, no, I'm going to keep it big. And by exposing us to big things all throughout the movie, it makes the smaller moments more impactful. Does that make sense?
100%. It's poetic. It never feels out of place. That's what I'm getting with what you're saying. Nothing feels out of place, whether it's big or small. And everything really feels like it has a purpose.
One of the things that I think is so extraordinary about this film is you've got a filmmaker who cast both of his sons in the film. And I think we all know that if a friend told us they were making a movie and that was their plan, I think most of us would go, are you sure? You know, like, not always a great idea. But in this film, God, it works. And there's such a care to the way the younger version is being treated. And I don't know, there's something so special about it. And, you know, Argento does this as well, where I watch Ossia Argento in some of those movies and go, oh my God, what was he thinking?
putting
his daughter in this crazy sex scene and then filming it, you know. And I still think it works. I think, again, that's a very American idea of the way movies should be made, is like, you know, you got to keep your stuff separate. You know, parents and children shouldn't talk about sex. It's actually very Catholic as well, which, of course, I was raised very Catholic. But I think in this movie, there's something so special about the children being in a film made by their father that is unrestrained. You know, it's not like he held back or made a children's film.
No,
I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
You know, it took me a few watches to realize that. I just didn't bother seeing all the credits when I was younger when I saw this. And sure enough, because I even remember saying, wow, they cast that little boy so great to the older version. They look so alike. They're so good. And it did take me a while and it was super impactful. I'm quite glad I didn't know because I appreciated it that much more. I mean, listen, I love casting my dad when I can in small cameos or my family in general. But exactly what you said, that he did not hold back. You can tell the passion behind the movie. And speaking of family, I think when they really believe in you, you can approach things so differently. But it's almost, I feel like it's Alejandro's upbringing, which I'm not familiar with. But I think making this kind of film, of course he can cast his family. I feel like the whole family just has that blood in them, that Santa sangre in them of talent. So I can only imagine that the youngest version of Felix and Felix himself as an older man, I feel like they understood their father more than I think any American family could, you know, or any typical family could. So I think definitely Alejandro had that touch already of a circus freak that his family can dive into the same thing. I don't know if that made any sense, but
no, totally.
It's exciting to think that.
I think it made a lot of sense. And I think that family is a really interesting thread that he weaves through a lot of his work. I know that he cast his son in El Topo as well. But with family in mind, you know, we're talking about sort of the celebration of dad and the sons and sort of the belief in the patriarchal art that he's doing behind the scenes. But I want your take on this film's view of matriarchy, because it doesn't seem as kind.
That left me speechless. It doesn't seem as kind. I'm already like, wow, you put that so gently. You know, I mean, the meaning of that word means, or is supposed to mean, sometimes I question it, but it's a system or a society ruled by a woman or multiple women. And I only really felt that just at the start, when all those women are gathered together defending this church. And that's the first part of the movie. You see all of these women come together. I mean, listen, like coming from Mexico and being Catholic, I remember my first impression of that. I couldn't tell that they were a cult yet. I could just see all these women gathering, protesting to defend this church, this building. I hadn't seen anything like that before. It's not only until today, in the last maybe 10 years, maybe almost 20 years, that women in Mexico gather to say no more to women disappearing, no more to women getting killed, raped, and all this awful stuff. And so seeing that in a movie from the time that it is, like, it's impressive. But it's crazy that it's only like that at the start. It's only like that in the one person, the one woman that keeps that power throughout, which is Conchita. Love her. One of the best actresses to come out of Mexico. It's like she was the only one that never gave up, never ran away, and was always protesting about everything she stands for. I think as a general symbol for her, I guess. Right. And it's impeccable. And it's crazy because I think all of us women that have seen Santa Sangre can relate to Conchita. We are always fighting for everything, to survive, to not be abused, to not be taken down, to not be said no to. And that is exactly what happens to her. She came from watching her entire group's church get taken the F down, comes home and heard supposedly awful husband is cheating on her.
Yeah.
And like, it's back to back. And I can only imagine that and still neglecting her own son because she's got her own problems. These are themes for women that we struggle with every day. We have so many things we're afraid of and so many things that we are constantly trying to be seen for. So even though she comes across as an awful mom, she's quite relatable in subtle ways. Even though she comes across as an awful mom, she is very relatable. Very. It's quite a big difference from, let's say, Carrie's mom.
Yeah.
Right.
It's quite different than Jason Voorhees' mom. I don't know those women's struggles. I don't.
Right.
Even though I fucking love them, like fucking like Misery, like there's no other bad bitch, you know, like her. But I know the one layer. And with Concha, I watched everything, everything, consistently.
Yeah, I love that you're bringing this up because I think, again, it's that thing where this movie, love Carrie. Carrie is brilliant, you know, and Carrie herself is layered and complicated, and she's both the victim and the monster, and that is brilliant. But Margaret White, not so much. You know,
Exactly.
it's very much of this is a crazy, fanatical, abusive person, and that's what they are from start to finish. And with Concha, this is ahead of Lorena Bobbitt. So remember, when she throws acid on the abuser's genitals, especially, you know, for a
Yes.
Mexican woman to attack a man that way. This is before Lorena Bobbitt had ever even done anything. It was not in the news. This is Jodorowsky creating a fantasy of a woman standing up for herself. And it was audacious and shocking and wild. And she, like you say, she has layers. You can be
Yeah.
both fucked up by what has happened to you, by the church, by culture, by society, by what men have done to you. Exhibit that and being a bad mother, but also you can be a warrior and you can be, in some ways, a feminist archetype of a character.
Yeah, totally. I love how she's just not perfect at all. I mean, when she went to go do exactly what you just described, she left her son in the trailer. She's like, I'll be right back. She never came
Just
back.
stay
You know,
here.
like it was, it's those kind of small, subtle mistakes that you're like, oh God. And I remember my mom saying, hold on, she can't leave her son in the trailer. Like, I remember immediately my mom pointing out little mistakes she would do along the way. But yeah, it's incredible. I loved that you asked this question, Michael, because it left me so quiet because I'm like, there is so much to talk about.
Well, it's interesting because the layers leave you conflicted, right? Because if you look at the movie, our two main female characters, one is in many ways the embodiment of the rage of a world that keeps putting itself upon her in different ways, and the other one has no voice. And there is this really interesting kind of
Exactly.
juxtaposition between the female archetypes because that's beyond the movie. That is culture for so many folks. It's like you're either pushed into the quiet solitude or treated as a witch in a certain way. And it's really interesting. And I think that it's handled really well, but also handled not well in the same measure. It's really fascinating because I think you could just walk away if you do not bring the insight in thinking that she's just a villain. But you brought so many wonderful points about no, there's such a relatability. It's sort of like, male audience, get it together. Pay attention, you know?
Yeah. Totally. I mean, I love that you brought up Almita, the mute, as well, because it is 100% the themes of women being silenced. I mean, insane, insane when the tattooed woman is bringing in men, you know, for you know, her prostitution and whatnot, and puts the one man in that room. I'll never forget that quote. That she says, don't worry about her. No one can hear her scream or something like that. No one's gonna know. She's mute and deaf. We won't even know. And it's so heart-wrenching. It just breaks your heart because that stuff is it's a symbol to exactly a lot of issues we have still today for women anyways. Actually, I think for all women and men and anybody. But it's true. It's true. I think it touches on infinite amount of themes, this movie. And I think anybody that actually takes time to really watch it, to really pay attention, can really take something home from this movie. I think Santa Sangre can easily, from a general audience, be viewed as just some whack, psychosexualized film that makes no sense. And it's very easy to do that with a general audience, but true, true people that are fans of cinema, I really think Santa Sangre is on that list from everything that we've spoken on this podcast about imagery, characters, technical wise, story. anything, you will take home something from this movie. And I gotta tell you both that if I get the opportunity for a remake or reimagining, I've been saying this film my entire life. I want to bring this movie to life in a different sense that actually just not even modernizes it, but brings out these themes in an unapologetic way that are so much more unfiltered that we can talk about.
Right.
I think this movie just kind of like what the reimagining of what Suspiria did.
Mm-hmm.
I think they really respected the original at 110% and brought out a reimagining that specified specific themes of the original. And I was like, I would do anything to be able to have that IP and that opportunity, or somebody should.
If you had told me that I would have enjoyed a remake of Suspiria. In fact, before it came out, I was like, oh, God.
That was my reaction, too.
And then it was one of my favorite movies that year. I just loved it so much. It did its own thing. It was inspired by and took the stuff from the original that it wanted to highlight. You articulated it much better than I am. But okay, so if you get the chance to do that, well, we will be first in line at the box office.
Oh baby, you're going to be my plus one.
We will be there. Oh my God. So speaking of which, I cannot believe how quickly our time has gone by. I'm looking at the clock like, wait, what? We've talked for this long. It feels like talking for 5 minutes. Is there anything that you're currently working on that you're excited about that you can share with listeners? If not, it's totally fine. We know some of these things, you know, often can't be discussed. And also, where can listeners keep up with you?
I'm the fourth on the list of Gigi's after Gigi Hadid on Instagram.
Okay.
And you can find me anywhere on social media at Horror Guerrero. Nice and easy. And we're always posting all these updates right now. Super excited. Both the last two anthologies I did are now both on Shudder and available on Blu-ray, Satanic Hispanics and VHS 85. And yes, you were right. I'm in every commercial. So you can see me now in a new Mr. Peanuts one, eating a lot of cashews. So I'm doing just a bunch of commercials, working on a video game. I quite can't say yet, but I'm voicing a very cool character. And I recently just finished and delivered my latest feature called Jenny, which is actually my first non-genre feature. It's a biopic of the life of the Mexican-American singer Jenny Rivera, which was a very, very, very big deal for the Latin community, especially in Long Beach and East LA. So I'm excited for people to see something different from me. And honey, right now is the time for all of us filmmakers to just go out and make something. It's very quiet. So it's given me time to just write stuff.
You are killing it.
So nice. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, Gigi, thank you so much for taking time to talk about Santa Sangre with us today.
Anytime.
And for being the influence for this whole episode.
You
were the one who brought it up when we saw each other at the movies so many months ago, and we kept it in mind. And here we are celebrating this magnificent movie today, and we'll be celebrating it forever because it's amazing. And thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It honestly inspired to take out my Alma costume for Halloween next year and be Alma again. My mom custom made me that.
Amazing.
So I got to do it again.
Give us pictures.
Yes, yeah. I will, guys. Thank you so, so much.
That was our interview with Gigi Sol Guerrero. Oh my God. That really was deep in a lot of ways. And she offered so much as far as contextualizing what watching this movie was like for her, but then also watching it with her mother. And what a great perspective. And I'm so glad she was able to share all of that with us.
Yeah, it was really great to dig into the elements of the film that maybe on the surface feel problematic, but then through Gigi's lens, looking at the lens of Alejandro, realizing that maybe it's not as problematic as we thought. It's a world that's problematic, giving us characters who are reacting to it. And I think that Gigi really gave us a thoughtful analysis about the film's patriarchal stance and matriarchal stance and how those are things that are still being deconstructed because we're dealing with issues in the world now.
Yeah, I agree. And she is herself a powerhouse of talent with everything she has going on, you know, for such a young filmmaker and actor to be so accomplished. Also, she's got that commercial gig, which, you know, if you're an actor and you can land commercials like she has with big accounts, it's like she's kind of living the dream. I love her success.
Absolutely.
As the young people would say, she is giving. Since you brought up young people expressions, this movie is extra. It's giving. Yeah, she is wonderful. Well, she is not our only superstar guest. This is the rare episode where, you know, sometimes we have two interviews of people who are obsessed with films. Once in a while, we'll have an interview with someone who's obsessed with a film and also happens to be a successful actor in their own right. This is an episode where we have two really successful actors weighing in on their shared love of a particular movie. And our next guest is someone who I have been a fan of his from the very beginning. I guess probably I was first aware of him in the film Party Monster with Parker Posey, but God, am I a big fan. And, you know, he's grown up to become such a hunk of a bear, which, you know, I'm a fan of. Quite frankly, I'm a fan of that, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if listeners knew that yet, but...
Well, who is it?
Well, it is none other than the sensational and the legendary Guillermo Diaz. And we're here to talk to him about Santa Sangre, which he watched for the first time because of us.
You know, that's a good point. We asked him, what are your favorite cult movies? And he gave us a list, and some of them we had already tackled. And what we did in return was give him a list of things that we had upcoming. And he said, this is going to sound crazy, but I've always wanted to see this movie. And this is going to be the reason I finally sit down and check it out. So that's unusual for this show.
Yeah, it is a true rarity because usually the folks who we discuss these movies with have had a lifetime entanglement with them. But because of Guillermo's approach to the material and excitement about it, we thought this was a good way to explore different territory when discussing Santa Sangre with somebody who has impacted culture so much in their own way. So without further ado, we're going to talk to Guillermo Diaz about Santa Sangre right now.
Well, hello, everybody. This is really, really exciting for me because I am such a big fan of our next guest and have been a fan for a long, long time. Working at Landmark Theaters back in the late 90s, I was lucky enough to screen a few of this person's starring roles as far as the early films he was in, including Stonewall, which we screened at the Bridge Theater. But I first became aware of our guest through Party Girl, co-starring Parker Posey. And I have followed his career for years and years, which honestly is too elaborate to list here because he has been in so many movies. I've admired him for being an openly gay actor when it wasn't necessarily cool or easy. He's definitely a trailblazer. More recently, you probably saw him in the movie Bros, but go check out his filmography. It is massive. And we adore him. We're thrilled to have him here on the podcast today. It's none other than Guillermo Diaz. Welcome.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for that flattering introduction, Peaches.
A million years ago.
Did we sleep together?
I sucked your dick. No.
That I remember. That's not the next thing you're going to ask.
It was this weird thing back at a club called Tranny Shack, or T-Shack as we call it now, back at the Stud in the late 90s, where I'm almost positive you were there and I was in this dumb contest. And for whatever reason, John Cameron Mitchell didn't make it. Were you friends with John Cameron Mitchell?
I was, yeah.
Do you remember coming to the Stud and judging a Hedwig lookalike contest?
Kind of. I remember Tranny Shack.
They threw you on the stage because John Cameron Mitchell wasn't there. And none of us girls knew Hedwig because it was only this underground thing at the Jane Street Theater in New York, but right. they had just put out the soundtrack. So they were selling CDs, and basically we were sent photos of what she looked like. And they were like, oh, John Cameron Mitchell couldn't be here, but his friend Guillermo Diaz is, so he'll judge the costume contest.
Oh my God.
I was, of course, just, you know, a young queen who was just, I had the biggest crush on you. And I was so excited because, you know, you're a bona fide movie star. So thank you for paving the way.
Oh, that's so fucking funny. Can you say funny on the podcast?
Oh, yeah, you can say anything.
But here's the question, Peaches. Did you win?
No, I lost. Porsche 666 won.
My ex-boyfriend worked for Atlantic Records, and he was Hedwig in the Angry Inches project manager for the soundtrack for the show, for the play that was at the James Street Theater, which is where John... Well, I think he first started at Squeezebox is where
yes.
he... created right. the character, I think, and then moved yep. it to the Jane Street Theater with Peter Askin, who was the director. But I was obsessed with Hedwig. We used to go see it like almost every week. And I saw it with so many different people, with Ally Sheedy. And
yeah,
it was nuts. Yeah. So I have a very sort of special place in my heart for Hedwig.
Well, that's where I first met you. And now we meet again 30 years later.
Right. Is it 30 already?
I God, don't know. Damn. But it feels like it.
God. You know, being 34 right now, I must have been so young back then.
Exactly.
I like starting the conversation on Hedwig because, you know, John has been on the show, but as we know, Hedwig is a very singular vision. And Santa Sangre is also a very singular vision from a very singular kind of filmmaker, much like John Cameron Mitchell. And Alejandro Jodorowsky really has a very unique body of work that is very separate from the rest of cinema. And every one of his movies on their own are kind of like huge discussions to be had.
Yeah.
But this film crosses over a lot of different things. There's queerness and circus and Mexico and all of this stuff that's happening. And I know that you just recently came to this movie, but like, what are your initial thoughts? How do you feel about Santa Sangre?
It starts crazy right off the bat. Like, I was like, oh my God, like that pool of blood that they're all worshiping. Mm-hmm. And I was floored, but at the same time, so excited because for me as an artist, like that's the type of movie I want to be in and the type of director that I want to work with that takes these outside of the Hollywood box risks and doesn't apologize for it, doesn't give a fuck. And that's so exhilarating and so exciting. So I was just like thrilled when it started. And I feel like I'm still processing what that movie was even about. I just know that it excited me. It gave me a boner. and I need to watch it like 10 more times.
This is exciting because you've just watched it for the first time and you're taking it all in. Now, I hadn't seen it in a long time. It was my friend Squeaky Blonde's favorite movie. And Squeaky and I would watch it while basically being wasted. And I've been sober for a long time now because I was wasted a lot. and I was watching it going, oh my God, I've never seen this sober. I've never seen this sober. But I felt like I was wasted all over again. You know what I mean? Because it was like, oh my God, this movie really is what I remember it being, which is right. insanity. And it's unlike anything else. And it's yeah. delicious and over the top. And, you know, so I guess getting into it, how would you... both of you describe this film as far as genre goes. That's what I was thinking. I was like, I feel like this is genre bending. It's
first of all, Squeaky Blonde. Did Squeaky Blonde used to work at FUBAR at Big Fat Dick?
Yes, yeah. she did. Yes.
I know Squeaky Blonde. Yo,
what?
Real quickly before we get small into the world. Movie, I remember they used to have the Big Dick Contest or the Dick
of course.
Contest. Get
Mario's
guys to
Club.
Out, take pictures of them. One night I was shwasted and I ended up in that back room, and this could be off the record or not, I don't give a fuck, but Squeaky was like, let's go, and like, you know, bluffed me and took a picture.
Yeah,
it got hung up on the thing.
Yes.
And at the end of the night, my boyfriend, who I'm still with, snatched it off the clothesline and took it with him, and I still have the picture. Like at home.
Amazing. That is definitely my dear girlfriend, Squeaky Blonde. You know, that was her job. She worked for Mario for many years.
Oh, I love them. I haven't seen them in so long. Please tell them I say hello.
I will, for sure.
If you're still in touch with them.
Yes.
Anyway, sorry for the tangent.
No, I love it. So, okay, you've just seen it. How would you describe it to someone?
It fits into so many different genres, right?
Right.
In Spanish, we say arroz con culo, which is rice with ass, because it just has everything in it. Yeah, I don't know. That's sort of the thoughts that I have about how I would describe it to someone. You know what I mean?
I think that this is one of those movies that almost defies genre in many ways, because just when you think you've got it nailed down, it goes somewhere else. And I do love his films. It's been a while since I've revisited some of the other ones, but what I always remember about Santa Sangre is, in a lot of ways, it's his most tempered movie. You know, if comparing this to, say, Holy Mountain, this
Is
is
it
actually,
really?
it is, oddly
Kind of,
enough.
yeah.
But I will tell you the thing, Peaches, that
Wow.
will not surprise you. It, when having to describe the movie when I'm tasked with it, but it wouldn't surprise you to know the first thing that always jumps out to me when the opening credits start is the very first name is Claudio Argento Presents.
Right.
He's Dario Argento's brother. I love, love, love Argento's body of work, but knowing that this is the guy who produced all of Argento's movies in Italy and is bringing that sensibility to this co-production in Mexico, I can see that Italian horror all throughout this movie.
Oh,
And I can
yeah.
see that like rich hyper color. It's a little bit giallo, it's a little not, but then we get the flavor of the horror movies of Mexico. I mean, I love classic horror. I love the Santo movies. And when we get the luchadors later, I mean, it's like you said, it's a gumbo in some ways. But then to sit down and tell people, I'm like, I don't know, I guess it's like an armless lady who makes him kill people. That's what the description on Shudder says, but I'm like, it is way more than that.
So much more than that. There's a child in the midst of all this, like super adult, like risque stuff that's happening. You know, who was that kid? I wonder where that kid is now.
So that's actually really interesting. Another Argento similarity is that Jodorowsky put both of his sons in the role of Phoenix. So the youngest one was his youngest
No.
son, and the older one was his older son. So they're real life brothers, and they are the sons of the director, which is wild.
Oh my God, that
Which,
my mind is blown. I cannot believe that.
yeah, and when you think about what the director is asking the sons to do, it's kind of wild and uncomfortable and horrific. And it makes me think of Argento, you know, having his daughter Asia, you know, fuck people on screen while he's like directing her. You know, I always feel like whenever I see her in a movie where she's naked or having sex and he's directed it, I'm like, oh God, oh God.
And it's more than a few.
I know. The mores are different. In some ways, they're very, very conservative. And then in other ways, they're, you know, totally wild. But yeah, those are actually his sons.
I wonder if that's going to continue with his sons. Like, I wonder if they're artistic and they want to be filmmakers and are creative and coming up with their own crazy stuff. Do you know what I mean? That's going to be so interesting to see, like, what they do in the future. Kind of like Madonna's daughter. I'm like, what's she going to do? Like, it's Madonna's daughter. Like, she's
Right.
already starting to do stuff. But yeah, that's wild. I can't wait to see what they come up with.
One thing that I really was keyed in on this watch of the movie that I wanted to bring up early, since we're talking about all the wild elements of the film, to me, one of the things that's the wildest, even though it's one of the most simple, is the music in this movie, because so
Oh,
often the
yeah.
music is like diegetic. It's in the scene. It's not a score elsewhere. It's like a band following them around. Sometimes it's the circus band. Sometimes it's like the band at Carnival. But you always see the people playing the instruments. Well, not always, but in through a lot of it. And what's your take on that?
Wow.
Because that's a really, it's almost like a black box theater kind of approach.
Yeah, it was very sort of concert like. Yeah, I didn't even realize until you just said that you're right. They're following them around, like the music follows them around. You know, when people say, oh, I wish I had a soundtrack, like the soundtrack of my life, or they talk about what their soundtrack would be. It's very that, but also it felt very organic too, right? Like I was never pulled out of the film by that. It all felt super organic and like it belonged there. It was beautiful. Was there one artist that did all the music, or were there different artists? Do we know?
I don't know. One of our listeners will know, because one of the things about our podcast is, as much as we know a lot about these movies, or we think we do, our listeners are obsessed, you know.
I'm sure the fans are like, you got that wrong. It's actually, yeah.
I did just look it up, and the composer for the music is listed to one person, and it's not who I expected it to be. It's Simon Boswell, who has done a lot of music over the years.
Oh, wow.
He's done music for, Hackers, and
Wow.
I'm trying to think some of these other movies. He seems to work with like Jodorowsky a lot when he does make movies, or did. Lord of Illusions, the Clive Barker movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Dust Devil, Hardware, Stage Fright, speaking of Italian horror, Demons.
Oh, yeah.
He composed the score to Phenomena. There's your Argento connection. So,
oh, wow. Interesting. That's so crazy.
Well, the music, I think, obviously, because it's so organic to what the movie is, what isn't natural is everything else. I feel like this film exists in this sort of surreal nightmarescape that is both beautiful. Like I love Mexico. We go to Mexico all the time. It's like one of my favorite places to visit, to relax. My brother lives in Mexico.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I just felt like this movie captured the beauty and the randomness of, you know, Mexico, especially like street parties and the sort of the idea of the circus tent being next door to the weird church. And she's somehow involved in both. While that's both surreal and bizarre, it's also kind of Mexican in a way. Like,
yeah,
there's this sort of beauty that it captures. And I wonder if you could talk, as someone who knows a lot about movies, I was taken by how beautifully shot it is and how well executed for a low budget movie, the costumes, the makeup, the special effects. What did you think of all that? I mean, especially for a movie that's so old.
Yeah, I mean, it was gorgeous. And it also felt like they really put thought into every single detail of that, of the costumes and the colors and the sets and just everything was, it was like everyone was on 100%, everyone and everything around the set. And even the background actors, it was like they were all on, like they were giving it like their complete commitment. And that's, I think, what really sells the film too. And as over the top as it is, the commitment of the actors, regardless of how over the top what they're doing is, their commitment is so on point that it just, it draws you in and you fall in love with what's happening, you know, and you're like, I don't know what the hell it is, but I love this. And I too love Mexico. I was just in Mexico City. It's so crazy. And you're right, Peaches. Like there's just, you know, I remember walking around and there were people with those, like things that you blow and it makes like a jaguar sound. And mm-hmm. and then there's like people doing a limpieza, which they're cleaning you with Palo Santo and with sage. And then, you know, there's a priest over there and they're selling crucifixes and then they're making tacos. Like it's all just so, there's just everything. They truly like captured that in the film, you know, the randomness and the complexity and the abundance of just things that are just going on all around you. That's so Mexico. It's so Spanish too. It's very Latino. I'm Cuban and it's very that.
And there is so much happening at any given time. One thing that I kept thinking about, just knowing, you know, what it takes to make a movie and as a filmmaker, as people who make movies, all of us, this movie, I don't know that you could make it today without it being hugely expensive. All of those crowd scenes and all of the, you know, the elephant funeral at the beginning, which in of itself is a conversation. But one thing I want to dig into, because there's so many cogs, but when you think of the year and decade that this was made, one thing we don't really get a lot in cinema is queerness. And there is a lot of queerness in this movie. And I mean, like there's the drag queens on the streets. There's sort of like the gender confusion situations, even just him being the well-manicured hands for his mother and like that whole thing. That's like, it's like drag in of itself. Right. So what's your take on the queerness of this movie?
I feel like they weren't afraid to go there, right? I felt like the director wasn't afraid. And I had a thought, like when you said, imagine making that movie now, I don't think they could make it now. Imagine like just the way we're all so caught up in the, you know, the PC of everything. You can't say that, you can't do this, you can't. Can you imagine a person with no arms? Like people would be like, you can't show someone with no arms and that's disrespectful or whatever. And there's a child in this movie. It would just be a nightmare trying to get this fucking movie made without people just jumping in and, you know, turning whoever is making it into this, you know, horrible person. You know, one thing that stuck out for me too was the son that's doing the arms, right?
Yeah.
It is the son and his hands, like his nails, right? Didn't he have full on like press on nails?
Oh, yeah.
She was so like queeny too. Like, I loved it. He was just like, hey, I'm playing this woman's hands and arms. I'm going to like be the girl. I'm gonna be super femme. Yeah.
Almost like voguing in a way, like the way that, you know,
Yes.
and I think you're right. Like we talk a lot about looking back at movies. I always use the example of 16 Candles because it's a John Hughes classic American film that we all love. We grew up watching it, but you watch it now and you're like, this is kind of rapey. And this is like really, really racist. Like Long
Yeah.
Duk Dong is so uncomfortable to watch. This is a movie where even though there's taboo stuff, like that some sort of trigger happy young person might cancel someone over, I would argue as the Gen X, you know, bitch, no, let's look deeper. Let's look at
Yeah.
what this film was doing at the time it came out. One of the things I really like about it is, yes, it deals with amputees and it deals with little people and clowns and drag queens and prostitutes and sex workers, but it does not have a judgment around these
That's
people. The
true.
intention
Yeah.
is to present folks, if anything, the people that are the shittiest are the people at the beginning when they bulldoze that woman's temple. You know, it's the
Yeah.
priest and the freaks, quote unquote, much like in Todd Browning's movies. Freaks, I would say, are put up on a pedestal here and are celebrated and are given a world in which they can exist in this way. Now, that being said, I wanted to talk a little bit about the giantess at the end because I feel like that would be something that at the time was presented as comedy. And in this film, I don't think she is. So here's this woman that's this obviously, you know, man playing a woman, this muscle guy, this wrestler. But I love the way she's presented in this film because it's without judgment. And in fact, as the audience, we're rooting for her. You know,
Yeah.
like I felt like I was like, fucking, you know, here's the protagonist, you know, trying to hurt this woman. I loved it when she threw him up against the wall. You know, I mean, it was amazing. And I was sad when she got killed. And I think that's the nuance that some young people miss. Is that this is a director who loves these people, you know? And that's queer. I mean, the queerness there.
Yeah.
The other queer thing that I think we should talk about is just sort of like, I feel like this is Norman Bates.
Yeah, it's very psycho.
It is. It's the extension of, you know, mother is making me kill these women. Also, it was surprising to see how many women he had actually killed. We don't really get to see him kill that many women, but then when he's in that cemetery, that dream sequence, and they're all coming out of the tombstones. He was a serial killer, right? Am I reading it wrong?
What are your thoughts, Guillermo?
There's so much stuff that happened in this movie you're talking about. I'm like, oh my God, that's right.
You know what's interesting about the serial killer thing that Peaches is bringing up is it does kind of pipeline us right to the end, that last scene when they come out of the house. Because I think with the queerness, with the otherness, this is where I think, Guillermo, you talking about sort of the PC conversations of today or the triggered conversations of today. It's trickier because I think that we're seeing a tide of people who want movies where their protagonists are always virtuous and they do nothing wrong. And at the end of the movie, we like them just as much as we like them at the beginning, et cetera, et cetera. And they can't do anything problematic lest we turn against them. But that's not what storytelling is. It's like you can tell stories about bad people. We can learn from stories about bad people. And what's really interesting in this movie is I feel for him the entire movie. Like I feel like he is tragic. He is living a life that is not his own. And yet he still does it something bad and he has to atone for it at the end of the movie. That is another thing that we couldn't do today. We couldn't have the tragic lead who's actually also killing all these women, you know?
It feels like everything is just, people are just trying to water down everything and make everything, you know, not too controversial. And that's just taking the art out of fucking everything, you know? I mean, because we're all bad, right? Like, who has not, I mean, but you know, we have, I mean, killed anyone, but we all are good and bad and all of those things. And that's what makes it so interesting. That's why this movie is so great. I mean, just imagine if it wasn't that way and every single movie had just had a cookie cutter ending and everybody was good, it'd be fucking boring.
We're so glad that you came on to talk about Santa Sangre because, you know, I got to re-experience it through the through without the lens of drunk squeaky blonde and I pissing in bed together because we were so wasted. And I love that you have a squeaky blonde story and that it involves her coercing you into, you know, taking a photo of your
Into a
penis.
back room.
Yeah. Which feels very Santa Sangre in some ways as well.
And I'm proud of that moment. I have no thoughts of like, I can't believe it. I'm like, I tell everybody that story. So I'm, you know.
If you want to know who Squeaky Blonde is as a drag performer, watch Santa Sangre. There is a reason it's her favorite film. Squeaky is a living circus monster of genius, bottled in a confusing mixture of just all of this wildness. Squeaky is the true essence of queer art, if that makes sense. In a post-Drag Race world, I think you could make a parallel between the drag queen that is Squeaky Blonde and the filmmaker that is Jodorowsky, because there is this purity to Santa Sangre. This is a person making a movie where no one's telling them what to do. They're not following any trends. They're not trying to win at the box office. This was just pure art, you know? Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And spinning off that, here's a question for both of you. If Squeaky, in some ways, is the embodiment of Santa Sangre in drag, one thing I love about this movie is exactly what you were talking about, Peaches, is the idea that, you know, the other and the queerness is tragic and celebrated all at once, but he allows it to be fabulous. And there are a lot of really fabulous outfits in this movie. And I wonder if either of you have a favorite, like what's your favorite look in this movie? Because there are some.
Wow, that's a good question.
There's so many.
I know what mine is.
Well, you go first then.
I love when we see our giantess luchador queen the first time she's in the ring. Yeah. And she's like towering with that, like the frills, and she's got the luchador mask on. It's amazing. Like,
who is the costume designer on this movie? Like, who did those costumes? That's another like genius person, right?
Totally genius. This doesn't really count necessarily as a costume, but I would argue that it is because it's part makeup. But I loved the villainess, which was the tattooed woman, you know, and the way that she looked, the way they painted her tattoos, which were so obviously not real tattoos, but it didn't matter. It worked. It looked so great. And she was in those sequin bikinis and she kind of existed in that outfit the whole time. Like that she's just kind of living in that outfit. Now, I don't know if it was a female trouble homage, but the whole idea of pouring acid or throwing acid on them was, to me, very John Waters and very female trouble. Now, we know that Jodorowsky was a fan of John Waters. At least I do, just because I've been reading about it. So it's like, that probably was a tribute to female trouble, you know? So
was the tattooed woman's tattoos real? Those were real tattoos, right?
No, I think they were painted on. And, you know, I'm so obnoxious that I was actually trying to, like, see where the differences were.
Really? Because people are like, that shit is a marker.
Yeah. I think it was like a sort of a water-based paint or something, you know.
That makes sense.
It looked amazing. I thought I loved her whole look. I don't know. I can't really decide. What's your favorite outfit, Guillermo?
Honestly, I don't even remember what it was, but the scene where at the end where he's being told to kill, right?
And yeah.
Hands, the arms, whatever that look was, just like, stuck with me. It was super powerful, and something about it was just like, I just remember that sticking with me. It was very, what was that performer back in the day? Klaus
Nomi. Yeah.
Yes. Somehow it reminded me of that.
That makes sense because he would wear those sort of extended shoulders.
Yeah.
And they actually built those costumes so brilliantly where the mother, who was so gorgeous, that woman that played the mother.
Oh, yeah.
And she was so good at being cuckoo, right?
Yeah.
Like Norman Bates, you know, her voice, kill her, kill her, kill her. And his arms having to come out from her shoulders. I actually thought they did such a brilliant job of it that I was like, where the fuck are her arms? You know, I'm guessing they tied them behind her.
Yeah. For a moment, I remember even thinking, watching the film, forgetting like, oh, that's him behind her. Like, those are not her arms. That's how good a job they did.
Yeah.
Like, it really messes with your brain. You're like, oh, wait. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, which is brilliant. I mean, it worked.
But then I'm just going to throw the wrench in the works here. If you have made it this far in the episode, listeners, you know that we do spoilers, but I'm about to drop a bomb here. So pause if you haven't seen the movie yet. Is it his arms? Like, I mean, it is his arms, but did they ever perform together? You know, like, because remember the reveal at the end when his mute friend comes back and shows him the body in the bed. I'm like, wait, where's the mom been all this time?
Yes.
Okay, so I think, obviously, she's in his head, right? She died.
Of course. Yeah,
but if you look, you can often see his head in this sort of this.
Of course.
In the crook of her shoulder. And Oh, so you don't mean literally, because literally they were definitely his hands and arms.
Oh, no, no, no.
Okay.
From filmmaking standpoint, of course they did that. But I'm talking about in the narrative of the movie.
Oh, yes. Because no.
Then we get the reveal.
Yeah, of course.
But it also does that thing that French movie High Tension does, that when you start thinking back, I'm like, well, I don't understand. That doesn't make sense to me. Because there's the scene where they perform with the audience, which then allows him to come out in that sort of like Myra Breckinridge gay glittery outfit and like throw the knives at the other actress. Yeah. And I'm like, but if the mom was dead the whole time, how'd this fucking happen?
The knives. I forgot about the knives. Did that anyone else get reminded of that I Love Lucy episode where Lucy cannot tell a lie or she's going to lose a bet with Ricky, Fred, and Ethel? And she tells this Italian performer, oh yeah, I speak Italian. And then she stands there and he's throwing knives at her all over her body. That totally reminded me of that scene.
I'm old, Guillermo, but
not that old. No one else obsessed with I Love Lucy, just me.
I know the famous episodes, but I think Lucille Ball obviously is the most hilarious, brilliant performer. I don't remember that scene. Before we let you go, because I know we were going to run out of time, I just wanted to say, like, your film career, your filmography is so amazing. There's so many movies that we could have had you on to dissect for this cult movie podcast that you've been in. But I just want to know, from your own filmography, what are the roles or movies that mean the most to you, especially as a queer trailblazer? I was looking at your filmography, and it's not just movies. You've done a ton on television. And I was thinking about you, and I was thinking, he really paved the way for a lot of these young queer performers. Because you did it in a way that was unique and very true to who you were, you know?
I feel like I was just a rabbit hopping along, like not thinking about what I was doing. I just knew I wanted to act and no matter what. And there came a point in my career where I was told, you either got to come out, because I had done a movie called Stonewall and I was starting to do press. And my manager said, you either got to say you're gay or you got to stay in the closet. Like, you need to make that decision. And I thought about it for 2 seconds and I was like, I'm not lying about my fucking sexual, I'm not lying about it. I can't be that guy. I can't be fucking Tom Cruise.
And how weird would it have been to have lied while being in Stonewall?
Oh, awful. Right? And then you got to continue to keep that lie going as your queer life is, you know, you're moving through life as a queer person. And it was too much. I'm too much of an anxious person. So I think with that attitude, I continued just to move forward. And people saw that I was honest and hopefully my work, you know, they hired me because of my talent, I hope, and all that shit just sort of fell by the wayside, you know, and nobody cared. But as far as the films that meant the most to me, the projects, the first one that came to mind is Nowhere, which was a Greg Araki movie. And
amazing.
I think for me, those directors that sort of, again, think outside of the Hollywood box and are unapologetic and provocative and just like a big, you know, F you to the world. Like, that's what excited me back then, and that's what excites me now, you know, that movie. And you mentioned Party Girl. My friend Harry Birkmeyer and Daisy von Schirlemeyer wrote the film, and she directed it. And it was a very quirky, like, you know, it was one of the first indie films that showed the nightlife in New York City in the 90s. And Parker Posey was in it, which already made it a cult classic before we even finished shooting, you know?
Yeah.
That's the stuff that excited me. And then sort of the bigger stuff was fine, whatever. Some of the big movies were fun and cool, but they don't have that sort of heart that the filmmaker comes in with, you know what I mean? When they start making the film, because they've created it and it's not something that they're creating for the masses. It comes from their soul, from their gut, you know?
While you were talking about the projects that draw you, you talk about being pulled towards filmmakers who think outside of the box, because I love when things are full circle. And we began this conversation talking about John Cameron Mitchell leading to Jodorowsky and how these are filmmakers with unique and singular visions who sort of exist outside of the mainstream. And what sort of brought you to us today is because you recently worked with another filmmaker who very much kind of embodies that. I've had the good pleasure of meeting Todd many times over the years at festivals. I know his partner, James. And so I was thrilled to hear that you were in this movie. And so could you talk a little bit about working with Todd Vrow and You Can't Stay Here, because it's getting a lot of attention right now. I know that it's queer, it's exciting, it's cult. So talk to us about it.
Yeah, interestingly enough, I was in New York City 2 years ago doing a TV show and I was recurring on it. The money was good, but creatively I felt stifled and not very fulfilled. And because I was in the city for that long and not getting to do much creatively, I was like, who do I want to work with? And I thought of Todd. Todd posted something on Instagram and I happened to see it. And I was like, oh my God, I want to work with him. So I DM'd him and I said just that. I said, I'm a huge fan of yours. I would love to work with you. I love horror and, that genre. Let's do something. And he hit me back. We met up. He was into it. He wrote a script in like 2 months, maybe
Oh my
less.
God, wow.
He had an idea about cruising, and again, I told him I wanted to do something in the horror thriller genre. He wrote the script, we kind of worked on it, and then next thing we knew, in like 6 months, we were shooting the movie. It's loosely inspired by true events. There's a book called Last Call, and there was a nurse, a gay nurse, back in the early 90s who was going around picking up gay men in bars and in cruising areas, taking them home, having sex with them, and then killing them and dismembering them, and then putting their body parts in different plastic bags and putting one in like the Bronx and one in
Yeah.
Jersey, and so they couldn't trace it back to him. So our film, it is a sort of stylized reimagining of those events. Again, it's very loosely inspired, and I play a photographer who is struggling with his sexuality, and he has a mother who's dealing with dementia, and he's living with her, and it's very interesting and macabre and sort of dark, and I love it. And again, Todd is that person. He wrote the script. It's not for everyone, and it's flawed and it's not perfect, but that's okay, because again, it has the heart and the grittiness and all of that is in it. So,
You just described the perfect movie for our listeners.
yes.
We actually did an episode on cruising not too long ago. It ended up being one of our more popular episodes. We are so looking forward to seeing You Can't Stay Here. It's just definitely right up our alley. And I think that everyone that's listening to the show is going to be looking forward to it. I guess it's out in some markets
Yeah,
now.
well, it's playing at the IFC Center in the West Village in New York City. It'll be there for like a couple of weeks.
So if you're in New York, you can see it
Yeah.
now. Yeah.
Yeah, you can see it now. And then it's going to open in New Orleans in a month or so, and it's going to be in LA in February. So it's starting to get out there,
That's awesome. Well, we
Yeah.
can't wait. Now, we're going to let you go, but the other tidbit that I just needed to ask you about, which has nothing to do with anything other than maybe Italian, something or other, is that I've heard that you are an obsessive Madonna fan. I just got to spend an evening with my drag daughter, Bob. She was here in San Francisco.
Oh,
They're on break. She
that's your
flew.
drag daughter?
Yeah, one of them,
Oh,
Bob and Jinx, are the most famous ones. But
that's amazing.
I feel like I now scream it from the rooftops, like, I'm the drag mother of Bob the drag queen and Jinx Monsoon. And then five others who I don't mention. No, I'm totally kidding. In case any of you abortions are listening, I love you too.
Bob is doing Madonna's show right now. He's like,
That's right.
right?
So
Yeah.
have you seen it yet? That's my question.
I'm seeing it in LA, yeah.
Okay.
And I was supposed to see it in Michigan, but then unfortunately Madonna, got sick and she was in the hospital, so she canceled a bunch of shows. So that show was canceled. But I am seeing her in LA and I'm really excited about it. Have you seen it, Peaches?
In February here in San Francisco. So,
Nice.
and my husband is like a Madonna obsessed fan. So it's the first time I've ever seen Nihat, my husband, kind of push for something where he's like, I'll be on the phone with Bob and Nihat kind of will run in the room and be like, yes, we'll take your backstage passes. Yes. And I'm like, I don't want to meet her at
You're
all.
like,
Like,
I'm good.
I love
Yeah.
her. I'm a huge fan. Changed my life, obsessed with her, seen many of her concerts, but I'm terrified to meet her.
I was too until I met her.
Okay, and how was it?
It was great. Well, I mean, it was an environment where there was no way she could be a bitch to me because it was on the Ellen show and it was on stage, it was on camera.
Right.
And Ellen knew I was a huge fan of hers, and Ellen's wife was on Scandal anyway, so I got to
Amazing.
live on there, and she was great. Does your husband have five tattoos of Madonna,
No,
Peaches?
you have five.
I have five freaking tattoos of Madonna. Michael, like,
Wow.
who's your diva, Michael? Are you a Madonna fan? Are you like,
I love
who
Madonna.
are
I have not gone to as many shows as probably both of you, but I grew
you?
up with her. I told a story. We did Truth or Dare on the podcast.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we did do Truth or
Oh.
Dare.
And I told the story about when I was a kid. I remember being like completely enamored by the fact that the Pope told us that we're not supposed to like her because that just made her cooler to me.
Yes.
And I love her. My friend Peter Stickles, who has been on the podcast before and is
I know
a
Peter.
Yeah, it's a very small world. Peter always texts me every time Madonna tickets go on sale, and we have a little group thread of Madonna gossip that happens, which I don't know that I've ever told you about, Peaches, because
I believe it. Peter wasn't on our Truth or Dare episode, but Guillermo, get this. We had Kevin Stay, who is what, fabulous dancer, from
course.
Showgirls and Truth or Dare. But not that Kevin isn't amazing. Kevin is amazing and I love Kevin, but
Yeah.
we got Mama Makeup on. And so
No.
you definitely want to listen to that episode. I'll send you a link to that podcast.
Please do. Did she talk about the night that she was drugged and her butt was bleeding and all?
We're really lucky. Like somehow her daughter is a Peaches Christ fan. And
No
so I,
way, of
yeah,
course.
so I was able, and Mama Makeup doesn't do very many interviews about this stuff. So it's a fascinating interview. And someone like us, like yourself, will be interested in it,
I love it. Wait, so who's Michael's diva?
I was going to say Rhonda Shear.
I do love Rhonda Shear. Yeah.
Rhonda Shear.
I thought the question was music oriented, but yeah, you're right. Rhonda Shear was so crucial to my being like a nerd.
Yeah, I don't know who it would be music. I know you really, really well, but I don't.
Bette Midler, Barbara Streisand, no.
No.
I'm not really as much of a pop diva guy. Madonna would be it in the world of pop. Otherwise, it might be Liz Phair, maybe,
Oh, that's true. Liz
Liz
Phair. You're obsessed with Liz Phair. I forgot about that.
I don't think I could name one Liz Phair song. I wouldn't even, if it played on the radio, I'd be like, I don't know who that is. That's so funny. I'm sure
Come
she's
to my
great.
seminar, Guillermo. I'm ready.
Guillermo, we could talk to you all day long. I'm so flattered that you came on the show. We are huge fans. Thank you so much. We look forward to seeing the new movie.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I so loved it.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with the fabulously smart and hunky Guillermo Diaz, like Gigi, another super successful, multifaceted artist, who does a lot of different things. If Gigi's conversation was focused, this was a little bit more wild. And it was fun to talk to him about stuff like I love that Squeaky is a running theme of this episode because the fact that Squeaky fluffed Guillermo and you're getting that. Exclusive and that it caused relationship problems when she took a photo of his penis. I just love it all. That was salacious and very in line with Santa Sangre.
I agree. And you know what? I really also love the conversation about Madonna because it may seem like a deviation, but when you think about the themes of Santa Sangre and the idea of blind faith, commitment to ideology, and how that can be both a boon and a curse, that is idol worship.
Yeah, and we started the show today talking about Claudio and Alejandro and the Italian and Mexican overlap as far as Catholicism goes. And I think Madonna is another artist whose, Italian Catholic upbringing really affected her work in such a way that clearly I have been majorly inspired by. There are these things as an older person that I can look back on and go like, oh yeah, seeing multiple maniacs and watching Minx Stole give Divine a rosary job and Madonna being fired by Pepsi because she performed in front of burning crosses and kissed a black saint in her Like a Prayer video. These are like life-changing things that led me on a path to better be able to understand my relationship with this upbringing that I have. And I like that full circle kind of like, all of this is, it's all coming from the same place. And, despite the fact that religion is responsible for some of the most awful things that occur in the world, part of its gift, if we want to look at it that way, is it's also led to fucking up so many of us who've used that as inspiration for interesting art.
Oh, and talk about a consistent theme across so much of the work that we love and music we love. Of course, Madonna's entanglements with Catholicism are well documented, and we've talked about it a lot on this podcast. But if you look at Depeche Mode, Personal Jesus, Pet Shop Boys, It's a Sin, these are all rooted in the same kind of things that inspire movies like Santa Sangre and inspire people like Madonna, inspire people like Peaches Christ. So I think that it is a really interesting intermixing because even when we deviate a bit, it shows that it's kind of like a wider web of cult interconnectedness.
thank God we have these outlets and music and movies and storytelling to express what ultimately, at the end of the day, I kind of consider it to be abusive brainwashing and indoctrination. But I don't want to get too deep, you know. Instead, go deal with it by watching Santa Sangre. I don't even think you need to do mushrooms in order to enjoy this film, but it might be fun. It is a trip of a movie. That being said, I do think we'll have some sort of a companion piece over on our Patreon. Michael and I have been really building up the content over there. I'm proud to say we've got a ton of stuff now between short films made by either Michael or I, all sorts of mini mass episodes. If you want extra content, extra deeper dives into weirder films, we've got lots and lots of extra, what we call mini mass podcasts over there, and a whole slew of other things. We have a Zoom party coming up with our Pope Popcorn, the third level Patreon subscribers. We jump online and have a streaming party online.
Like a real-time face-to-face conversation.
So that's coming up. So lots on our Patreon. That's my pitch to you. And finally, we have new merch. Michael and I have a new t-shirt that's just been released. It features artwork by the brilliant Travis Faligant of IB Trav on Instagram and on his website, ibtrav.com. And it was actually his idea to do a take on maybe one of my most favorite one sheets ever in the history of cinema, which is the original A Nightmare on Elm Street. So Michael is the scream queen. And it's I don't know why, but Peaches is the monster.
You know, it's one of those mysteries we'll just have to forever wonder.
I'm sure the listeners are baffled by this concept. I mean, it should be me as the damsel in distress and you as the scarred and burnt creature terrorizing me. That's how the podcast feels.
One thing that I think we can all agree on is that you are a distressing damsel. That's
well, speaking of distressing damsel, get that t-shirt because we have a limited supply of them. I'm telling you right now that there's a lot of mediums out there because we've sent, you know, most people are ordering mediums. That t-shirt is available at the new and improved peacheschrist.com. So not only do you get to grab a t-shirt to show your love of the Midnight Mass podcast, but you get to see the new website we've been working on.
And it's gorgeous. Peacheschrist.com.
Thank you. Thank you. This is a special episode. Like, I just love this movie so much, and I'm so glad that we get to share it with people. And if you, too, are the jilted lover of a slimy, abusive man and decide to take matters into your own hand with a vat of acid, much like Edith Massey in Female Trouble, you, too, might be one of the children of the popcorn now.
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.